Singapore.
Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Now let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour on this Saturday, April 1st, of the Personal Wealth Coach.
Yes, exciting.
The Personal Wealth Coach with a little circled R after it. And you're welcome to give us a call in here.
Yeah, and the there's a footnote marker under the word exciting, and that is, this is exciting second hour to us, not to you.
Wait a minute. They could be excited.
We could hope that they're excited about this.
Well, I mean, let's start off with the telephone number in here, 254-773-1400, if you would like to say something exciting or not exciting, as the case may be.
Or exciting to us.
Here's one of the headlines that won't make big headlines. Probably, I don't know. I don't read the local paper very often, so it may or may not have been reported on March 30th. If it wasn't reported on March 30th in big headlines, probably should have been. The national debt is on track to nearly double over the next three decades. Now, that should get somebody's attention.
Say that again. You got my attention. What's going to double over what period of time?
The national debt. And when we say the national debt, we're not talking about in terms of dollars. We're talking about in terms of percentage of gross domestic product. Right now, let's put it like this. In 2007 or thereabouts, we had a debt that was equal to 63% of our gross national product. And it's now up to 77. I realize there's some people who say it's 100 and something or whatever. And there's an argument there too. But the point is that when we talk about the national debt, we're talking about debt held by the public. That means actual treasury securities issued that somebody outside of the government holds.
Right.
And says, you must pay us this money on this date.
Now, the bigger number, the one that's often quoted, is somewhere right in the 20 trillion figure, is including debt that the government owes itself.
Well, it's not just owes itself. It's a projected debt.
It's a projected debt.
It's the present value of a projected debt.
And then there's the 120 trillion number that is thrown out there so often. USA Today loves that one. And that's basically calculating all future possible debts as a present value only in the future's version of it. So it'd be like saying, don't have a child because that child's going to cost you $1.3 million.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is
that's never due at one time.
And the total debt that we owe, the dollar value goes up, but as long as a combination of inflation and gross domestic product are rising faster than the debt, the real debt drops. So when the Congressional Budget Office talks about debt, they talk about real debt. Real debt means that constitutionally obligated to pay somebody outside of the government.
Right.
Now, let me explain what I mean it's going to double. We're about 77% of gross domestic product is our debt held by the public, which is not a record.
Wait. Oh, okay. 77% of our GDP
right.
annually mm-hmm. is the amount of debt that we have.
Yeah. So okay. it's gotcha. Kind of like if you would say you're running a business and you've got a certain amount of profit and you've got $100,000 profit after paying everybody, including yourself, you had $100,000 profit and you have $77,000 in debt obligations that eventually will come due.
We're in pretty good shape. Yeah, that's pretty healthy.
Yeah. But if we don't make positive changes by either reducing spending or increasing taxation, or at least revenues to the government, that will rise to 150% of gross domestic product eventually, 30 years from now. Now, 30 years from now sounds like a really, 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 really long time, except that there's a lot of us who remember 1987. That was 30 years ago.
Right.
So the point is, 1987 was not that long ago. It was the Reagan Revolution. We were in the middle of it. We just passed. By the way, that was the last time 1986 Tax Reform Act was the last time we rewrote taxes, and it went into effect in 1987. Of course, a lot of people remember 1987. Well, not a lot of people. There's not a lot of us left.
So it is a long time.
Because there was a stock market crash that year. But still, 1987 is not ancient history. We'll go that far into the future, and at that point, when the debt outstanding, the debt held by the public, hits 150%, the ability of the United States to grow will be strongly affected.
Yeah.
That means
very, very much hampered.
If you got a kid or a grandkid that's 10 years old, when they're 40, they're going to be staring a very serious problem in the face. Now, is it difficult, impossible, or even hard to fix? Fiscally? Not hard at all. Politically, probably
very,
nearly
very
impossible
difficult.
At this point. Let me explain a couple of things. The Trump administration made several promises, one of which was really good. Actually, two of which are really good. They promised repeal and replace Obamacare. I really don't think that's going to happen. They promised a major tax reform with tax cuts. And they didn't say how they were going to pay for the tax cuts. The Republicans in Congress were the ones who came up with the idea of the border adjustment tax, and the president's never been behind it, which the border adjustment tax would simply shift the taxes from corporations to people who shop at Walmart. And I don't think that's going to go over real well. Basically, let's not tax people in the investment class, and in return, let's tax people who live paycheck to paycheck. That isn't going to go over real well because it just won't work. There's some other things that he promised, though, that actually make sense, that work out, and they could solve this problem. Now, among other things, he promised we're not going to touch Social Security. We're not going to touch Medicare.
That just tied everybody's hands behind their back.
And he also promised health care for everybody. Now, here's the point. Can he fulfill those promises? Could President Trump turn around and become a truly great president very quickly, except for the fact that somebody would have to take his Twitter and get rid of it, and he would have to fire his immediate personal staff, the people who advise him, and get some people in there who actually understand what's going on in the world? Neither one of which do I think is very likely. But here's what he could do. Just keep his promise. 100% health care for everybody. And stop the massive deficit from growing, start shrinking it, and cut corporate taxes in one fell swoop. It'd be entirely possible to do. How would you do that?
Yes. How would you do that?
Hang on to your seats, folks. If you look at the United States of America statistically, and you look at the number of dollars that we spend per person, not per insured person, not per patient, but per person in the United States on healthcare, it's 30 to 50% higher than the European countries. And they have what is the equivalent of, in the best example, is one that is very similar to TRICARE. Do we have a call?
Yes, we do.
So we do have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was wondering if you could explain something to me. I just read in the newspaper that there's a stock out there that's a communications company that may be reverse splitting 25 to 1, well, as high as 25 to 1. If that happens, is there much chance of that company surviving?
Dad, the reverse splitting or splitting really has next to nothing to do with the company's survival.
Doing it.
And what happens is the stock price has gotten very inexpensive, obviously, because they want to buy back 25 shares and convert them to one. But the mere fact that they're doing that indicates they have liquidity.
Yeah, well, this is more the issue. When a stock does a reverse split, it's generally because they have to meet a minimum price threshold in order to stay on an exchange, which means that they've got bigger problems than the reverse split.
Mm-hmm.
So if a company's stock, for instance, the NASDAQ, I haven't looked recently, but I think the NASDAQ has a minimum share price of $1 to be traded on there. And if their shares are dropping quickly and they need to stay on the exchange if they hope to recover using investors' money or allow their investors to keep selling out of the company for that matter, mm-hmm. then they have to do a reverse stock split. The reverse stock split doesn't change anything internal to the company. If you have two stocks and they say, give me those two stocks and I'm going to give you one stock that represents both of those, you still own exactly the same percentage of the company. And if they say you have one stock, but I'm going to give you two stocks in its place, then you still, again, own exactly the same percentage. The reason why somebody would do a stock split rather than a reverse stock split is because they want, one, there's some hype around stock splits, which is in the professional world a little bit absurd, because it doesn't change your ownership. But it allows some people to step in and buy a whole share that they wouldn't have been able to. So, for instance, if you want to buy a share of Berkshire Hathaway, it's something above $100,000. I haven't looked at it recently.
A share.
So they say, you say, I want to buy Berkshire Hathaway stock, and people go, whoa, that's too expensive. There are some other share classes that you could buy. But the reality is Berkshire Hathaway doesn't want low net worth people buying their stock anyway, because they're likely to sell it quickly. They want people that are going to buy it and hold on to it. So the less expensive the stock is, the more available it is to the general public. But that also means it takes on the volatility of the general public. So doing a reverse stock split can be good to say, hey, we want more astute investors to be doing this. Or it could be bad because their stock price is dropping so fast that they're about to be taken off of an exchange.
Okay.
Or
if they go ahead and do the reverse stock split and they continue paying the dividend, what happens to the dividend?
Well, let's talk about the company, because that could be different for every situation. What company are you talking about?
Frontier Communications.
Okay. All right. Frontier is a cable and internet provider, and it has purchased some infrastructure from Verizon and may not have gotten the best deal on it. We don't recommend individual stocks. This is one of those that this is a great example of why, because just a few years back, they had a glowing future. And at this point, they haven't made any bad decisions, but technology shifted a bit for them. So as their user base drops based on prices because they bought an older set of infrastructure, their stock value is dropping. And I believe that they are on the NASDAQ. Let me see what it says here. Let me see if this is why they're doing it. It looks like they're trying to stay on the exchange. So it isn't the stock, or the reverse stock split isn't them. It isn't the reason why they're having trouble. It's a symptom of the trouble that they're having. Does that help?
Yeah. The reason I was asking is I used to own it decades ago when it was called Citizens Utilities.
Right.
And I just happened to be reading an article, I think it was in Bloomberg's or something like that, that they mentioned this particular company and that they might split, they might reverse split 25-1.
And, you know, you'd have to look at
that's a big split. That's a big reverse split.
It is, but it could be that somebody just purchased a controlling interest in that company and is in the position where they want to turn it around. And it is very unattractive to investors if it's a penny stock.
This is one of the keys here, and this is one that you can look up very quickly. You can go to Google Finance. You can go to just about any online reputable finance source. And what you'll find is that Frontier's dividend has been paid from borrowed money. And if you're talking about what a reverse stock split is going to do to the dividend, the real question should be how long can they keep borrowing money to pay the dividend? Because the reverse stock split has nothing to do with how they pay a dividend. It doesn't have anything to do with their profitability or lack thereof. If they're paying a dividend out of borrowed money, it's kind of like you saying, I need a pay raise, so I'm going to write myself a check from my credit card. If you go and spend that check, somebody owes it. And if you're the shareholder in this case, somebody's got to pay it back, and that somebody is owned by you. So if you own Frontier based on the dividend, that's probably not the reason to own Frontier. If the dividend is nice to have, then you should be immediately reinvesting it. If you think we're not going to recommend any individual stock, but if you really think it's a good deal, then you should be reinvesting your dividends unless you're needing the income. If you're needing the income, it shouldn't be from borrowed sources. So we can look at this one and say, this is a company that I wouldn't get involved with. And just from the offset there, the reverse stock split is a good example of a symptom of a major problem.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks for the call. Is that pretty much what you would have said in the same? I answered most of that call.
Yeah, I basically, people used to buy Dell when it split because the stock would go up after it split. That's indication of an unhealthy bull market. And it sounds like we have another caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Y'all probably have addressed this in the past, but can you speak to buying gold and silver? You see so much of it on TV, and I know people that have bought gold recently, and it's gone down. I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
There's a couple of answers to your question, no and no.
We're not going to talk about it?
No, we will.
This is a question. Can you talk about it?
We will talk about it.
No, we're not going to talk about it.
There's a fundamental issue with gold or silver, and it's political in the United States. It is
It's semi-religious, too.
It's economic somewhere else. Basically, if you purchase gold or silver in the United States today, you are buying a commodity that is based on the economy of India.
Yes.
So
to some extent also the economy of Russia and South Africa.
Right, but mainly India, because apparently the correlation, some degree China, but it's India and China. China can stop it at any point, but India doesn't want to.
Yeah, so the demand is from India and the supply is from Russia, South Africa.
Right. So what you're buying into, if the price of gold goes up, it's because people in India decided to buy more gold because they have a better economy. If the price of gold goes down, the primary cause will likely be that India is suffering from some kind of financial crisis and the price of gold will drop. Now,
there's a good reason for that, too.
That's what they use for their reserve. That's
right.
What they invest in. They don't trust the banks. They don't trust the currency.
The currency has just gone through some major revisions. They're using jewelry and they're bartering right now.
So let me give you an example on gold and silver. First off, the big picture from an economic point of view on gold or silver, is that neither of them make money. Stocks make money. Bonds make money. I mean, if you buy a bond, if you buy a 2.3% 10-year treasury, then for the next 10 years, that treasury note will pay you 2.3% a year. So it's making money for you. Now, is that a good deal or a bad deal?
That's a different question.
How much money will gold make if you buy it for you? No, it's got a reverse value. As a matter of fact, you can leave it stored in a vault, which is what the majority of people do.
That costs money.
And this is an interesting thing. They hold the gold because they want security, but there is no guarantee that the gold that they purchase even exists. Now, if you get the gold in your hand, if you actually take delivery of the gold, then you've got a problem because it has to be assayed.
Unless it's in coin form.
Right. And
then the value is more collector value. You're talking about a baseball card rather than the gold itself.
And if you do have gains in there, then they're not subject to you can't get the long-term capital gains rate. They're full rate. There's a whole lot of negatives to it. But above all, gold doesn't make money. It costs money to keep. And that makes gold negative. And for the last 600 years, if you draw a nice little line over the last 600 years, you'll notice that gold has fallen about 95% in value over the last 600 years, and it continues downward on the long-term trend.
So I've had several listeners over the past several weeks ask us where we get that information, because how do you maintain prices when currencies aren't even the same over 600 years? And there's an easy answer to that. There's measurements of how much gold can buy as a percentage of a well-educated person, and a really good example of that would be a hand-tailored suit that you would wear in an extremely formal occasion. So back then it may have been going to a king's court. Today it would be you go to a good designer and have them hand-design a tuxedo or a ball gown. Those prices maintain a steady state based on the wealth of the nation that you're in. And if you think back, well, you wouldn't be able to think back to 1600s unless you were looking at it in the 1400s, you go back 600 years, you could take a very small amount of gold and buy a very nice suit. Since then, the New World was discovered and a lot more gold came into the market. And then South Africa started digging gold, and there was gold booms in every location imaginable. Siberia, across the globe, we're really good at finding gold now. There's a lot more gold. We're finding it faster than we're having babies. That means the price is dropping because it's a simple supply-demand issue.
And at some point in the future, if the price of gold stays right where it is, it will become cost-effective to grab asteroids made out of gold.
Yes, and if you look at the price of a tuxedo made today and how much gold you would have to hand as far as ounces to someone to hand-tailor you the suit, you're talking about 2 or 3 ounces of gold, which would have bought you a city in the 1400s.
Yeah, so gold... The other thing you got to remember when you see a lot of people advertising gold, the reason you see so much gold advertisement is because it's not regulated by the SEC. It is not federally regulated. You can just say anything you want, pretty much anything you want to about gold on the air, and there's no regulation. We were talking about the necessity of regulation earlier. So people can make – there's an advertisement that comes on here on this, if you listen on the air, that said a few weeks ago, this will be sold out in 2 weeks.
But they played that commercial
for a couple of months.
Now they've only recently changed it to say to remove that it's going to be sold out in 2 weeks.
But they also say that they only have 1,000 slots, and they've been trying to sell this 1,000 slots in this investment type thing for months now, which means that they're really desperate to sell.
If you think of how much money they're spending on the radio spots to sell it, because this isn't the only station that they're using to advertise.
So the bottom line to it is when somebody is spending a lot of money trying to sell something.
Huge amounts of money.
Like gold and silver. It's probably because they think selling is a really good idea. When people spend a lot of money to do something, a corporation that's trying to make a profit, I'm confident they believe it's a good idea. So they believe it's a good idea to sell gold. Now, that should tell you a world about whether or not you should buy gold.
Right. So, and let me hit some of the key economic and political reasons why you're hearing a lot more advertisements for gold right now than you heard even 2 months ago. It kind of corresponds to the same time last year. It's not seasonal. It has to do with the debt of Venezuela and Russia. They have a lot of gold reserves, and they're sending their gold reserves to Switzerland to pay their debts. So they send the gold reserves to Switzerland, but you can't pay your debts in gold. Switzerland is where they sent it because it's a major exchange for gold. So they sell the gold in Switzerland. A lot of people in India buy it. Some people in the United States, all over the world, they buy it, but they get it from Switzerland. Mm-hmm. Think about the shipping costs of something that heavy going, physically going from Venezuela to Switzerland and then to the place where it's being bought again by a corporation. They have to buy it at very, very low rates from Venezuela in order for the shipping to wherever they need to resell it to be. This tells you it's a commodity. It's not something that by itself creates value. You can consider it valuable because it's scarcity, but as you just said, if it just maintains its current value and one of these other 10 or 15 space companies that are going into space strictly stated to mine asteroids, they'll be able to get up to those asteroids and over a period of 10 years, bring that asteroid back into a closer orbit with Earth, mine it, bring it back to Earth, drop it on barges, and sell it in Switzerland.
It boils down to the fact that we're about to have another...
We're about to have another new world discovered as far as gold
that,
goes.
That really,
and silver and platinum.
And the other thing that's sort of fascinating economically to us, at least to me, is that gold has followed bonds so tightly since, for the last decade or so. In other words, if bonds go up, gold goes up. If bonds go down, gold goes down. It is really sort of ironic. Gold hit a bit of a high point last summer, and it's down about 9% since last summer. If you go back to the early 1980s, and you look at purchasing an ounce of gold, and you look at the inflation between then and now, you realize that the price of gold has dropped really substantially since 1980 in terms of buying power. So all the arguments that you hear to buy gold are pretty much negated.
It's similar to other commodities. If you think about the price of oil now, even at $100 a barrel.
Which it isn't.
It isn't. But what it was not very long ago at $100+ a barrel, it's half that now. But at $100 a barrel, you would say, well, that's a lot more expensive than when I was a kid, because it cost me 15 cents to fill up my go-kart for 1 gallon or whatever, and now it's like $2 and something. Well, it's not true with go-karts, but it's certainly true with other vehicles and to some extent even with go-karts, where we use a lot less gallons than we used to get the same distance. Our miles per gallon has gone way, way, way up. I had a 1982 Dodge pickup truck, and that Dodge pickup truck on a good day got 5 miles per gallon. And we've got another caller on 773-1400. Go ahead, caller.
Well, I just want to say that I think a lot of people buy gold because of a fear of a next depression or economic collapse or something like that.
Mm-hmm. And that would cause gold prices to go down if we had an economic collapse.
Yeah, if we look back at the Great Recession and the Great Depression, what you'll find is that in the Great Depression, gold wasn't altered at all because it was part of the currency and it was maintained by the government. And in the Great Recession, gold prices dropped.
Yeah, and that's people buy it to protect against a depression or a recession, but every indication we have says it'll drop.
My question is to the man on the street out here in downtown Temple, wherever he's at, or out in the country, it doesn't matter. If that happened, if we had a total collapse, Great Depression, whatever,
right,
what's the most valuable to you, a 50-round box of 22 shells or a gold Coogaran?
I would think that you'd, let me tell you, I've told this to a lot of people, said, well, I need to buy gold and store it in case the currency collapse and the country collapse. Let me tell you, if the word gets out that you've got a cache of gold, because how are you going to, how's the word going to get out? You're going to spend it to survive. As soon as people, if we have a total collapse of civilization.
And unlikely speaking, gold still maintains some value that you could buy something with, even though you cannot eat gold.
Then if we had a collapse of civilization and people knew you had gold, you wouldn't live very long.
Yes, well, so the box of 22s is a better deal.
I'm speaking from experience. I had some once, and I went down to the bank to borrow some money, and they didn't know what gold cougarans was. The man on the street did not know what a gold cougaran was. But I'm just saying that you can't eat it. You can't. It doesn't make very good soup. You can't. What are you going to do with it? You know, in a situation where we have a collapse, what are you going to do with it?
You could be a dentist.
Anytime that you see someone, particularly somebody famous, that's hawking gold, saying you should buy gold, one of two things is true. Either the person is of such low intelligence that it's astonishing, or they're lying to you. There's just no in between on that subject. That's
well,
my
exactly.
opinion.
It's not another thing. If you had bought, let's say, a real nice Winchester or some kind of real nice gun 30 years ago, compare that to you buying gold when it was $3,000 an ounce. Which would you rather have today?
$3,000 an ounce.
Well, with inflation adjustments.
Oh, you're right. You know, and who was the guy? Beck, Glenn Beck. Did you know that Glenn Beck recently came out and apologized for his gold sales efforts?
It was a court-ordered apology.
Oh.
Because he wasn't disclosing that he was owning huge chunks of the corporation that was selling it.
He officially apologized, but he not only because of the conflict of interest, in that basically he was getting paid a lot to say that, and he claimed it was objective advice. He also apologized because since he told people to buy gold, the prices dropped pretty dramatically.
Well, and I'm just expressing a little, use a little common sense here. You know, why are you buying the gold, and what are you going to be able to do with it?
Yeah, and you're right. By the way, I don't think if the total society collapsed, I don't even think the 22s would be much good for you.
Well, they probably wouldn't, but I'm just saying the man on the street can identify with a 50-round box of 22 shells, and he probably cannot identify with a gold cougarant.
You are completely correct.
In my situation, the banker could not relate to a gold cougarant.
And
what it was.
And actually, you're completely correct in every aspect of that.
Just a piece of real advice here. If the banker can't identify the cougaran, taking them the nice Winchester's probably not smart.
He probably didn't change banks. Okay. I'll leave it with you.
Okay. Thanks for calling. That was a good insight.
Yeah. We don't give personalized advice very often, but taking a rifle to the bank probably is not the way you want to do your investing.
Yeah, I think the gun show would be the better place.
Yes, that would be a better place to do it.
And there's a lot of realities about money that people are not. But we were talking about money, but we got to do commercials. I want to talk about the Congressional Budget Office report and what we can do about it.
All right, we're going to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to contact us off the air, you can reach our phone numbers locally at
254-773-1400.
This is on the air. If you would like to contact us
locally,
off the air,
254-947-1111.
And then you can reach that toll-free. That's voicemail right now at 1-800-914-7526. We have our emails open if you want to send in an email and don't want to hear your voice on the radio. That makes sense. Email Jeff at tpwc.com or Jake at tpwc.com. We've got commercials to play. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. Hello. Ooh,
we scared
them off. Yeah.
We scared them.
I want to talk about just a second what I said earlier that we could do. I don't think politically it's feasible, It might be. And I think the president could do this if he were just to throw his tweeter in the trash and settle down and do some serious business. And that is, we, as I said earlier, we have a deficit. We have this very major difference between what we pay in taxes and what we spend in the government. It's that simple. There's no...
Well, if we get rid of waste and fraud.
How many times have you ever heard that?
It's kind of like the newscaster that says, or the sportscaster that says, well, what I think they should do to beat the other team is they just need to score more points.
The point is that if somehow you could get rid of all the waste and fraud in the government, the deficit would be just about as big as it is today. If you got rid of all foreign aid, the deficit would be just about as big as it is today. There's only a few things you could get rid of, and people are not going to get Social Security, Medicare, and defense. If you get rid of those three, we'd have enough money to run the government. But I don't think anybody wants to do that. So let's come up with a better alternative. In the United States, we spend the highest percentage of our gross domestic product on medical care of any developed country. We spend 30, depending on which nation you look at and which program you look at, somewhere between 30 and 50% more per person in the United States on health care than any other developed country in the world. Worse, when national surveys are done about what we think about our health care,
we're a lot less satisfied with it.
We are very far less satisfied than they are in Britain, or they are in Germany, or they are in Scandinavia, where they have what we call socialized medicine. We have socialized medicine in the United States,
yeah,
but you just have to be 65 to get it.
Well, we also have – let's just be real. You don't have to be 65 to get it. If you're getting medicine today, it's socialized medicine. If you go to a doctor today, unless you have – and even in this case, unless you have one of these concierge doctors that just don't take insurance at all, then you have socialized medicine. And even in that case, that doctor's residency and internship was probably paid for by Medicare, which means you've got socialized medicine. It's through the system already.
It's partially subsidized by Medicare. In many cases, they borrow a lot of money to
get through medical school. Well, they get through medical school on their own. The Medicare money that goes to the hospital to pay for the internship and residency is why the residents and interns get paid so little, because they're being paid indirectly, but the money comes directly from Medicare.
So the point is that we have in the United States right now a system, and I'm not saying it's the ideal system, but we have a system that we use for military retirees, and military retirees start at age 48.
Wait, did you say
38? I'm sorry.
Retired military retirees
and their families.
Is that re-retirees?
Right.
If
sometimes
they're retired retirees.
But the point is that military retirees and their family are on something called TRICARE until they get to be 65, and TRICARE spends about the same amount, as far as the budgetary issues are concerned, about the same amount as they do in Europe. And the government pays, in essence, a health insurance premium for the people. The people then use the system. It's called TRICARE because there's three different levels, and how much you want to pay out of pocket depends on what you get paid for.
And there are a lot of people that are really satisfied with TRICARE.
Yeah, and there's universally a lot of happiness with it. If the United States of America, if the Congress of the United States and the president, if the president were to fulfill his promise that he would have health care for every single American, and married too, I guess, every American would have health care, and he'd have this great bill. Basically, Congress could say, we're going to raise your taxes enough to cover the cost of TRICARE, and we're going to put everybody on TRICARE. And at that point, without messing with anything else, suddenly the United States economy and federal revenues would rebound. We spend 20% of our gross domestic product in the United States. One out of every $5 spent in the United States is on health care. We could easily reduce that to $4. So then we would suddenly have available to us, this is just to me one of those amazing things, instead of spending $1 out of every 5, we could spend 75 cents. Or you could say instead of spending the full $20 out of 100, we could wind up spending 15, leaving us with that extra $5. That extra $5 would be enough to make up the difference between what we spend in the government and what we take in revenue, and begin to pay down the debt with having, and at the same time having no negative effects in the economy. Better yet, doing it that way, if you did it as efficiently as certainly as it could be done, we'd put ourselves in the position where we can rebuild our infrastructure, pay down our debt, everything the president promised to do.
Okay, and I'm going to come in, you wanted me to do this, with an opposite perspective.
Okay.
There's another way of doing it. And the other way of doing it is to go in and unintertwine government from health from one end to the other, which would cause Medicare to stop working and TRICARE to stop working, which is politically a lot more infeasible than what you're talking
about.
Wait a
minute. What I said, we can't shut down Medicare.
No, what I'm saying is that if we went to a system where, for instance, the government is involved, obviously, in the whole Medicare system, but they've set themselves a huge amount of restrictions on how they can not negotiate with pharmaceutical companies based on large bulk purchases. Can't do it.
So who would run Medicare if the government didn't?
Well, I'm saying there's an extreme opposite is if the extreme opposite, and it could work, it just would be a complete dismantling of the system, would be completely remove socialism from the medicine. And most of our listeners, while the beginning of that remove socialism, they might say that's great. It means no TRICARE. It means no Medicare. If we went to a true capitalist, let the folks compete with each other, there's a one section of medicine where the prices have consistently gone down over the past two decades. Only one area, it's elective care. It's the stuff that insurance and Medicare won't cover. It's eye surgery so that you can not wear glasses anymore. It's plastic surgery. It's extreme, and it's a lot more far-fetched than going on to a universal system. But both of those have an ability to work.
But a complete capitalist system with no government intervention.
Well, the government intervention would just be to make sure that what they're providing meets the standard of care.
Okay, but again, that means the sick people don't have insurance.
Well, what it would mean is that the insurance companies decided how the insurance company bought their insurance and the sick people did it that way. So let me say another area.
Because we used to have, in essence, a situation where healthcare companies within states operated without federal supervision, and people who were ill, who didn't have group coverage with their employer,
were unable to
get insurance.
There's an answer to that, and it was coming along before the Affordable Care Act, because it was having to be put together. It wasn't being done well. Long term, it may have been done well, which was forming groups of citizens that weren't working for the same employer. So Scott and White here, before it was Baylor Scott and White, was beginning to form a large Central Texas group that just basically said they would cover existing conditions, they would cover all these things, because if you didn't have a group sponsor like an employer, employer plans have for decades covered existing conditions. So what I'm saying is we either go all the way and admit that it's socialist, or we go all the way and don't, but this hodgepodge regulatory confusion where the doctor doesn't know how they're getting paid, the patient doesn't know how they're paying, and the government doesn't know how they're paying, the insurance company doesn't know how they're paying. So you get these convoluted, messy situations. You either go the route you say to fix it, which is universal. That's a lot simpler because you've got less to dismantle. Or you go totally capitalist, which nobody would like because Medicare goes away and TRICARE goes away.
I just can't even imagine that an insurance company would consciously insure a person with cancer.
They do. And they do it without having been regulated to do it. Because
they just don't cover the cancer treatment?
No, they cover it. If they have a group, if, for instance...
No, I'm talking...
Wait just a second. If there's an employer group, Walmart, they cannot cancel care for the cancer patient because Walmart will move to another insurance company.
They cannot cancel care because there's a law that says they can't.
They used to cancel care and they used to not cancel care depending on who the employer group was. So before the law came out, there were huge companies covered, and you would choose your care based on that.
I can assure you that if enough people with cancer were working for Walmart, they wouldn't be able to get health care at a reasonable rate.
And that's kind of the problem.
And then the issue is when within society, it is in the capitalist best interest of an insurance company to provide coverage to healthy people and not provide coverage to unhealthy people.
Right.
And if you say get the government out of it.
Well, the government out of it with some minimum regulation. The minimum regulation isn't to say to an insurance company, and this is hard, it's not going to happen, but it isn't to say to an insurance company, you must cover these people. Instead, let the market do it, because if – and you're looking at that, but you just – advocated for a true socialist medicine, go all the way hilt deep.
No, I didn't.
To do something like what's happening in every other developed country.
No.
To go to TRICARE or to Medicare. That's a socialist.
Don't put words in my mouth. Canada has a socialist system where all the physicians work for the government.
Yeah.
In Europe, the standard system is the physicians are still private. The hospitals are still private. There's some of them are corporate. They work very, very well. It's just, in effect, the health insurance is funded at the governmental level.
Okay, so insurance is socialized.
No, the insurance companies still exist.
But they are completely mandated on their controls, their profit.
No,
the amount
no,
that they – yes. In
no.
Germany, the amount of profit that they can make is mandated by the government. Based on how much money they receive from insurance revenue.
The ability to get insurance above the basic coverage is only regulated as much as any other insurance company is. They're not they don't have a special health regulation in Germany or in Great Britain. There is basically, it's like Social Security, not like Social Security, it is similar to Medicare. It is less regulated than Medicare. It is so the point is you can choose your hospital, you can choose the doctor. Yes, under the governmental system, the doctor for a procedure or for a visit is going to get a fixed amount of money depending upon their locale. But you can buy insurance above that, which is completely competitive, as a competitive and as any insurance companies in general. All insurance companies are regulated either by the state or the federal government. Insurance agents are regulated, the companies are regulated, and they are forbidden to make excess profits. There's a whole series of things that because insurance companies can be extremely predatory. They have the controls if something goes wrong. And in many cases, for instance, in long-term care insurance and in disability insurance, there is a serious problem in that the insurance companies, you pay into them for many, many years, and then when you have disability, they say, no, you're not really disabled because you could go and pump gas sitting in a chair.
That's correct.
Of course, the fact that there are no jobs pumping gas and you can't do it sitting in a chair anyway is totally beside the point.
Right.
And this is where we have to – the individuals have to go in and sue the company.
Or
payment.
Or you have what's happened in the automotive world or in most of the rest of the world. You have companies that make their name by going in and saying whether or not the product is good or not.
But my premise here from the beginning is that the government is spending a lot more money than it's taking in.
That is correct.
That needs to be fixed.
That's also correct.
There is a place out there where there is a tremendous amount of waste and fraud.
Correct.
That could be corrected. The government could collect a piece of that, and we could solve that problem.
Yeah, and that's the healthcare system in general.
Right.
Medicare specifically as a chunk of the budget, but healthcare in general being in the state where it is, where expenses are far higher than they should be. Because we don't have a free market system, but we don't have socialism either.
To give you an example of why I don't think a free market system would work very well. is a complete free market system.
Complete free market is anarchy. That doesn't work at all. So go ahead.
Well, okay, a capitalist system.
Mm-hmm.
We have a problem right now in that if you have a serious set, you're taking a series of medications and you have medical conditions and you are away from your home doctor and home hospital and you find up in an emergency room because of an automobile accident, how do the emergency room doctors know what medications you're on and what your medical condition is? And the answer is, in general, they don't. They have to guess.
That's correct.
In the rest of the developed world, uniformly, there is a national healthcare system, computer system, that any physician anywhere can access instantly and see exactly what medications you're on and exactly what your medical conditions are so they can treat you without having to incidentally kill you in the process.
Yeah, and I think that concept is really great. And if the insurance companies work together to do similar things to what they've done for auto insurance so that a police officer can look at your license plate and know whether or not you have insurance and the amount that you have and what company provides it, that's a good idea. That is a form of regulation. Just like having a license to be a doctor is a form of regulation. And I'm not saying that the government should get completely out of that to make sure that the doctor's a neurosurgeon that's about to operate on your brain instead of a chiropractor with the ability to.
So, but again, how would the going capitalist and getting away from socialism and killing and getting rid of Medicare and TRICARE help the national debt?
That's a
I'm not
big,
I'm talking about the debt held by the public,
right?
Not the Medicare cost.
Well, the Medicare cost, the debt held by the public. Well, just let's say
Medicare
something
is paying for itself right now.
Well, sort of. If you count the fact that in the next 3 years it won't be, that Medicare is as a chunk of the revenue to the government is about a third as an expense and an income. It's paying for itself, but if you look at all revenue going to the government, Social Security, Medicare, and defense are all those three, that's all our revenue. Anything else we do beyond that is borrowed money.
So who would then pay for the health insurance if Medicare is not?
Who pays for it now? It's paid for by the government, but who pays the government?
But we've already paid in. Those of us who are on Medicare have already been paying for many years.
But you started paying in when there were 32 workers per retiree. If you treat it like we're all entitled to something that is not long-term feasible, at some point, Medicare is going to be really, really upside down. We got to fix it between now and then. And as I see it, there's two ways of doing it. Neither of them are very viable. And we have to break for the week. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we give advice to high net worth people on their investments and their portfolios. You can reach us locally at
254-947-1111.
You can reach that same voicemail toll free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can listen to podcasts. You can read our newsletter. You can read our philosophy and figure out our beautiful staff. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
JTM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood. Proud to broadcast to the largest military post in the free world. News Radio 1400 KTEM.